Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now.
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. For Monday, October 21st. Joining me in the studio today is
Peter R.H.
and Danny, your community journalist for CJSF.
And my name is Magnus Tiefeld. We got a great show for you today. We are, of course, going to start out talking about the election. It was a close one on the weekend and remains in many ways undecided. We're also going to have our regular segment, Gardening with Embark. And what are you going to be talking about?
Talking about the history of British Columbia politics, W.A.C. Bennett. Who was the British Columbia Premier from 1952 to 1972. And I'll be talking a bit about that and other little incidental things about the history of politics in British Columbia.
Great. Well, that'll be up later in the program. So in the election on Saturday, it was and remains a squeaker with the NDP either elected or leading in 46 ridings. The Conservative Party, who at this time last year were basically a non-entity in BC politics, but now they have 45 seats, either elected or leading, and the Green Party with 2 seats. Danny, you've taken a closer look at the numbers, and a bit of a look at what's happening in our area around here in sort of eastern Vancouver.
Yes. So, as you said, the Conservative Party of BC, which previously held no seats in the province, is now leading or elected in 45 ridings, whereas the NDP is leading or elected in 46 ridings and the Green Party in 2. So both David Eby and John Rustad were able to hold on to their riding, but the leader of the BC Green Party, Sonia Fursanot, was unable to. So with the current division of seats, neither the NDP or Conservative Party are able to claim a majority government.
Yeah, because 47 seats are needed to form a majority of the legislature.
Yeah. And one thing that was interesting is on the night of the 19th, Conservative Party leader John Rustad stated that this election had sort of signified a change in the BC political landscapes, specifically towards the desire for a conservative government, whereas David Eby stated that, you know, if you actually look at the votes between the NDP and the Green Party, this election actually marks a majority vote for progressive policies.
Mm-hmm.
This is you know, quite a stark contrast in statements, but I think it's one that sort of signifies the current polarization we're seeing in the split between the votes this election. Now, while the NDP is slated to lose roughly 10 to 11 seats in this election, they held a significant majority within the major Vancouver ridings, whereas Conservatives proved popular within the interior and south of the Fraser Valley. Regardless, both parties are within reach of forming government, which should be decided sometime between October 26th to the 28th.
There are a number of seats that are really, really close.
Really close, yeah. A big part of the time it's going to take is going to be the recounts, because so many of them are within 100 votes.
Yeah.
And, yeah, if it is within 100 votes, then they automatically have to do a recount for that. In regards to Burnaby, though, for our local Burnaby ridings, it was actually quite a significant sweep for the NDP. So to list that out, for Burnaby Centre, the BC NDP candidate Ann Kang won with 56.93% of the vote. In Burnaby East, BC NDP candidate Rhea Arora won with 51.51% of the vote. In Burnaby New Westminster, we saw Raj Chauhan of the BC NDP win with 59% of the vote.
Yeah.
And in Burnaby North, Janet Rutledge won with 52%. And Burnaby South Metrotown, Paul Choi of the BC NDP won with 49% of the vote.
Great. So mostly fairly strong leads there in those ridings.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a significant lead, especially when you consider just how tight so many of the races were for some of the successful ridings.
Yeah. I heard, you know, when I was listening to results on Saturday night after the vote had come in, it was interesting following it on the various, you know, TV news presentations or on the radio. Because, you know, in past elections, they have a new system for counting votes this year, which has the votes being electronically tabulated rather than hand tabulated by people at the polls, election workers at the polls. So a lot of results came in very quickly and kind of all at once. And then there was a long pause where they weren't getting more information, which was sort of different because, you know, traditionally what's always happened on these election nights is, you know, pretty much as soon as the polls close, you know, results start trickling in. You know, 5 minutes, there's one or two polls coming in per riding typically, and then, you know, they keep coming in, so they're getting more and more information as the night goes on. Whereas this time, you know, by 9 o'clock they had a lot of the results in, but not enough to call... but with enough not in that they, you know, it took a while to call some ridings, but then they didn't have anything new to talk about for a long time.
I think that was the thing. I think a lot of people expected with the new voting system to sort of have those results pretty immediately, and in some ways that was the case, but it's just the fact that this election was just so close, right? So there are, so many recounts that need to happen. There are so many votes that need to be accounted for in order for us to get a full picture of what's going to happen.
So what do you think an election like this or results like this sort of mean for the province in terms of, you know, what we're voters trying to say here?
Well, I think all of us see it every day, you know, as people that live in BC, is that there are a lot of people that are just... compared to 2017, are just dissatisfied with their material conditions and for many justified reasons. And I think, when that happens, it's hard for the party that's currently in power to convince people to, you know, have that be maintained. And I think that's what we saw mainly with this election. But not necessarily just that. I think a lot of what we saw... is almost par for the course in some ways. You know, 2020 was obviously a significant majority for the NDP, but, you know, in 2017, you saw that there was still quite a significant split. I think a big part of that is that, you know, when you look into the interior and in the Fraser Valley and areas like that, there are significant sections of ridings that are more conservative-leaning, whereas you look at Vancouver and some of the more densely populated city areas, and those sort of lean more NDP. I think that's what we saw here as well.
Yeah. One thing I heard someone say in the coverage on Saturday night was, you know, this election amounted to a real repudiation for the NDP, which is certainly, I think, a reasonable interpretation, because I think they lost something like 17 or 18 seats or something like quite a lot. Down from what they were prior to the vote. But I also think, you know, it's not so much a repudiation of the NDP per se as a repudiation of the status quo that we seem to be having, not just in BC, but everywhere. And that seems to be a big factor in politics these days because, as you mentioned, people are really unhappy with how things are going. You know, the economy seems to be going okay, but people aren't feeling that in their pocketbooks or, you know, in their daily lives. They're still feeling like, you know, costs are going up too high and it seems a bit like the system is broken.
It's basically the inflation. That's the problem right now. It's not as such employment. It is inflation that we're dealing with in the United States and Canada.
And certainly you're seeing with young people coming out of school and whatnot and really having a hard time finding, you know, long-term jobs. You know, they can get work, but it's not what they're, you know, it's not getting them going in life, getting them started in a career. And I think, you know, and then the struggle to, you know, around housing, whether it's you know, rents, which have gone up astronomically in the last number of years, or, you know, the ever-increasing cost of purchasing a house, which is making it more and more difficult for people to do that for the first time. And these are all issues that seem to be really troubling people, and I think it creates that, you know, a certain kind of reactionary politics where you know, it's less about specific policies or less about, you know, specific initiatives, and it's more about people just really unsatisfied with how things are going, and looking for change of some sort or any sort.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, especially as someone that's within that age range of, you know, younger people that have recently graduated from university, you for so much of your life, you are kind of sold this thing that, you know, the way to go is you get to university, you get a job, and then at some point you're able to own a home. I think a lot of people my age are starting to come to terms with the fact that just may never happen, yeah. Specifically the home ownership part. Yeah, and I don't think it has to do with, you know, specific policies per se. I think it's a big part of it is, oh, I'm not currently satisfied with what's going on. I'm just going to go with what the most popular alternative is to the current party that is, you know, maintaining what is going on, in my eyes.
One of the things that was interesting on Saturday night was John Rustad's speech. Not a concession speech, because things are too close and they haven't conceded yet, and maybe they won't have to concede, depending on how these how things go in some of these close ridings. But he really talked about, you know, often the convention is you get up there at the end of the election, you talk about how we're going to be working together. You know, he was very much, oh no, we're going to try and bring this you know, if we're not forming government ourselves, we're going to try and bring this government down as soon as possible and force another election. David Eby took a very different line of talking about, you know, the needing to work together and hoping that they could work together with the Greens to, you know, I guess form a government, but also to move forward. But that certainly speaks to the idea that this kind of divisive politics is going to continue. You know, if the Conservatives are going to take that sort of obstructionist line where we're just really going to try and get in the government's way on everything we can, and prevent them from doing just about anything and try and force an election at the first possibility, that certainly doesn't speak to a very productive era of politics going forward.
No, it certainly doesn't. And I think part of that is probably by design, you know. A lot of the Conservative Party's campaign was just them sort of pointing out the wrongdoings of the NDP. So I think, you know, if they go that route of sort of being obstructionist, that kind of adds fuel to the fire for that.
Yeah, on the national broadcaster this morning, they had someone from the party who seemed to be backing away from that sort of. They have like this panel of, you know, representative from each of the main parties, and the representative for the Conservatives really seemed to back away from that sort of obstructive position. And then they did have John Rustad on afterwards. He didn't quite repeat him, you know, that stuff, but. He didn't entirely repudiate it either, so we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, I think that's sort of been the case with a lot of statements from the party in this election cycle. Yeah.
All right. Any last thoughts on this?
Just that I think it'll be, you know, very interesting to see sort of how this develops. Yeah, whether. You know, if the NDP is able to form government, whether the Conservatives are going to sort of now take up that space as sort of like this obstructionist entity.
Yeah.
And also just, yeah, what this means going forward. You know, say the Conservatives do go in power, what does that mean for the province? You know, how if they're only able to have a minority government, how much is going to change, I guess, in the upcoming months.
Yeah, I think it'd be very difficult for, you know, unless they were to pick up some seats in these recounts coming up. And I guess mail-in ballots are also coming in, which, you know, could affect things. Mm. You know, unless they get a majority, I think it'd be very difficult for them to be able to work with the Greens to form a government. So unless they get a majority, it seems like it, you know, what we will end up would be with the NDP and the Greens working together. Because, yeah. I mean, there's just so huge differences on some key environmental policies, of course, particularly, but also on their policies on what to do about the drug crisis and a number of other areas between the Conservatives and the Greens, where they're really almost at polar opposites on those issues.
Absolutely. Yeah, the NDP and Conservatives are more close in terms of drug policy than that of the Greens.
Yeah, totally. All right.
If I could just say, very strongly there's going to be the Greens, the NDP are going to collaborate, and that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And in 2017, the New Democrats got 41 seats to the Liberals 43, but because there were three Greens and they did a coalition,
yeah,
they had the majority. They had one over 43. They had a 44. Collaboration. Now then, really the only reason that an election was created in 2020 was because they wanted to be away from the Greens, and they had COVID during that time. But they could have kept that coalition. So I think it's going to be a stable coalition.
Yep.
Between NDP and Greens. That's my
prediction. That does seem to me the most likely outcome. One thing to think about, too, and this was a factor again in 2017, is that one MLA from one of the parties is going to need to be selected as a speaker. Mm-hmm. And that will take that person, you know, out of the voting block. If your numbers stay exactly where they are right now, we have, you know, NDP Green would be 48. Conservatives would be 45. One of those people, I think you can guarantee that the Conservatives will not give up, let one of their people go to be the speaker, reducing their numbers by one. So likely that's going to be someone from the NDP. So now you're 45, 47, which is pretty close. I mean, they're going to have, when they're in the House and going to key votes, they're going to have to be very careful that everybody is there, mm-hmm. that they don't get caught out with not enough people. I know often in the past in situations like this, when parties have been willing to work closer together, they sometimes have an agreement. Like if someone's out of town or somebody's sick, you know, and not available for a vote, someone from the other party will also sort of, you know, they sort of try and play fair like that. I don't think that's going to be the case here, particularly given, you know, John Rusted's declaration that he would like to bring the, you know, force an election at the first opportunity, you know, so we'll see how that is. I mean, that's not a lot of breathing room, and they're going to have to be super careful when it comes to key votes that are confidence votes, that they have the numbers to not get defeated, because they don't have much of a margin there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a very interesting dynamic, I think, in the House once that get settled.
Any final comments, Peter?
No, that's the major one, just to say that I think I'm pretty sure what's going to happen. They will have a coalition. The next election, if people are dissatisfied, the Conservatives could get in because of dissatisfaction, but and present a new era in BC politics. But other than that, I just think it will be I don't think the NDP are going to get the majority by themselves.
Yeah. I guess one other point that's interesting is, you know, with the Conservatives being such a new party and having so many new people, there's almost nobody in the party that's been in government before. John Rustad has been a minister in previous Liberal governments, but almost nobody else has you know, experience in government, which would be very interesting were they to at some point claim power. But again, I don't think, it doesn't look like that's this, you know, unless something really, we get some real big turnarounds in these recounts coming up, that doesn't seem terribly likely.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. All right, thanks for that, Danny.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Here's a story about making birch bark canoes from our one of our local journalism initiative partners in Ontario. So enjoy this, please.
If you were to walk into Trent University's Battle Library, you would see something unexpected. Just inside the entrance of the typically quiet library, there is a functioning pop-up workshop and someone building a birch bark canoe. Throughout the month of October, Alex LaBelle will construct this canoe from start to finish for all to see.
Well, last week on Monday, I was actually commissioned a couple months ago to build a canoe for Trent, and I wasn't sure where I was going to be building it, and I came here, Battle Library, in the summer, and they said, this is where you're building it. So Monday I came in and unrolled the bark and started folding it up to take the canoe shape, and now it's about 20% done. So there's still a lot of work to be done, about 800 feet more of route to be tied on there. So it's definitely a big project.
LaBelle is relatively new to building birch bark canoes on his own, but has been around them for most of his life while working with his grandfather.
So, originally my grandpa started a couple years, I think maybe 22 years ago, and he started building in schools, and he wanted to retire about 6 years ago, and he's built about 10 canoes since, so he's trying to pass it over to me. So I said, I'll take this project and you take a break from it and actually get a chance to retire. So that's why I'm here, and I wanted to carry on the tradition because he's been able to pass it on to me since I was 5 or so years, like when I could understand what was going on, he was able to pass it on to me. So since then, I've been traveling along with him at his builds in schools and universities everywhere across Canada, and actually it sent him to Peru, so really? That's pretty cool.
And this project comes from Trent University's First People's House of Learning, or FPHL, and LaBelle credits the idea to elder and knowledge keeper Lorenzo Wheatung, who grew up in Curve Lake and works as the cultural advisor for FPHL.
I've traveled around a little bit, and I've seen a lot of birch bark canoes hanging up or on a shelf somehow, adorning a place. And I thought we needed one that we can use. We can actually get in and use it. So I talked to Don LaBelle, Harvard, over in the First People's House of Learning. Mm-hmm. And we decided that, yeah, this was something we'd take on. But in the planning stages, the dreaming stages, we said it had to be done in a good way all through. So we had a feast to ask Alex if he'd build this canoe. And we had traditional food there. And so the canoe did begin in a good way.
So this canoe build is largely was Lorenzo's idea. We had built a canoe with the First People's House. I think it was probably back in, oh, maybe 2017, we had a little bit of a pot of money, and the students wanted to learn how to build a traditional birch bark canoe. Now, recently, we have led a number of living off the land canoe trips on Manitoulin Island the last 2 summers in a row as part of some, you know, reconciliation dollars that we received. And some of the feedback that we got out of that was, you know, how amazing it was to participate in this experience, to go on the canoe trip, to, you know, have some teachings about living off the land. But it did come up at one point that, you know, how amazing it would be to learn how to build the actual canoe that they were traveling in. And so we put our heads together, and we made a request actually to the Sisters of St. Joseph, who have been incredibly supportive. They have, you know, made some pretty good contributions, especially helping us create an endowment fund to support Indigenous students' needs. And so they were very generous in finding some dollars for us to build this canoe.
Dr. Dawn Lavelle Harvard is the director of the First Peoples House of Learning, and she spoke a little about the cultural significance of the birch bark canoe.
The canoe was essential to our survival. I mean, we often joke that, you know, when you're little and everybody envisions Indigenous peoples and they think of, you know, the sort of riding horses and teepees kind of Indians, so to speak. But our people were on the waterways. Our people were fisher people. We survived from the fish. We survived and we traveled the waterways across this province. I mean, especially all around the Great Lakes. And we were not horsemen and teepees. And so this is the central to our survival piece of technology that allowed our people to trade. It allowed our people to, you know, big war parties would go down in their canoe. It allowed, you know, whether they were out harvesting rice, whether they were out, you know, you get, I know Alex was joking this morning that this would canoe would be big enough to load a moose in, mm-hmm. but you know, like, it has to be big enough and functional enough, because that's the survival of your family. That's the difference between surviving through the next winter or not, was your canoe. And so the skills to build a canoe, which, you know, unfortunately are disappearing, you know, it's, and that's why Alex and his grandfather being here is so beautiful, and they're helping to teach some of those skills to our students who are having that ability to participate and help, even if it's just in a small way, mm-hmm. in passing on that tradition, because that was literally the difference between surviving the next winter or not, was if you had your canoe.
Mm-hmm. So they came up with the canoe. That's the canoe's blueprint is based off of your body. The skin is the birch bark, actually. So, yeah, starting off with your skin, the birch bark represents that. Then, well, under your skin, you have muscles. And because this is an incomplete canoe, you'll see later on there's a picture on that slideshow, actually, that has a start of the inserting of sheathing and ribs. So the sheathing is about 3 to 4 years of sapwood off the cedar tree, and that's most flexible. So it's like our muscle. It protects the bones, the ribs, and the ribs are made of the hard wood inside of the cedar tree. So that's your bones, your muscles, your skin. And then to hold everything together, we use spruce roots, and those represent your tendons, holding everything together. When we wrap along the canoe's gunwales, we use 5 holes, and then we reuse those 5 holes on the way back after wrapping 5 one way, and then we'll come back 5 the other, and that represents 10 digits, so your fingers or your toes. So that's the aspect of that. And then when you cut yourself, you bleed. So we asked the spruce tree if we could use its blood, the spruce gum, to seal the seams and the cuts that we make in the bark to make everything fold together.
And this project is more than just a canoe build. It's hoped to be a learning opportunity for students. And even while we were talking, multiple students were assisting Labelle strip bark from spruce roots. But it's also intended to be a reconciliatory act to reclaim Indigenous knowledge at Trent, as Lavelle Harvard explains here.
I really encourage anybody who's listening to come sit with Alex. You will get to actually put your hands in building this canoe and contributing to what will be, you know, in future generations. You'll be able to say, I remember I helped build that canoe when you come, because it will be here for another 100 years. It will last. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, having it be that product, and that's why it's here in the middle of the library. So after we did that, we have the new library staff are really very committed to their reconciliation strategies, and they had come forward and asked if there was something we could do together. And we had mentioned that we wanted to build a canoe this year, and I jokingly said, well, we could do it in the library, and they were 100% on board. They have been fabulous for doing this sort of archival stuff, for putting together, you know, different resources for the learning opportunities, and for students to come and see the sort of larger context of learning about the canoe.
You can find Labelle working on the birch bark canoe just inside the entrance to Battle Library until October 25th, after which there will be a naming and launch ceremony in the Otonabee River at a time that is yet to be announced. This has been Eddie Sweeney reporting for the Local Journalism Initiative and for CFFF FM 92.7 Trent Radio here in Peterborough, Ngozi-Wanong.
And here is some new music from Sleater-Kinney. This is Say It Like You Mean It.